Buongiorno a tutti. Ecco la prima sfida linguistica. Parlo in inglese perché gli organizzatori mi hanno chiesto a parlare in inglese e forse è meglio perché il mio accento è uguale in tutte le due lingue e quindi adesso faccio lo switch in inglese. So in this paper I'm specifically concerned with the Anglo-American system of copyright, which is of course a legal artifact of the common law world, which has now been foisted on the rest of the world thanks to principally the World Trade Organization TRIPS agreement, but also a whole lot of bilateral agreements principally concluded by the United States of America. So my comments are not principally directed towards the system of diritto d'autore or author's rights, but I would observe that as a result of pressure from the international level and also the process of European lawmaking, there has been a substantial convergence between the common law system of copyright and the European system of author's rights, which has tended to favour aspects of the copyright system over the system of diritto d'autore. Okay, rhetorically, as everyone here I'm sure knows, copyright associates itself with values of innovation, creativity, cultural production. My purpose in this presentation is to reflect on the extent to which these values are really embedded in copyright law and the extent to which they should be embedded in copyright law. In light of this inquiry and the fact that I'm speaking about copyright and not diritto d'autore, I would like to start by making some very brief observations on the historical origins of the English system because they are very pertinent to the place we are in today. Generally, the system of copyright and author's rights are regarded as lying, or the origins of these systems are regarded as lying in the 15th century system of printing privileges and printing privileges which operated in the Republic of Venice. And this system, with various differences, eventually found its way into the system that prevailed in other European countries, including, of course, England. To cut a very long and very interesting story very short, innovation was absolutely at the heart of the Venetian system and the English system, but that does not mean that either system, in fact, focused on creating an innovation right. Rather, both systems were a response to innovation in the form of the printing press, which was the information technology revolution of the 15th century, of course. So these systems are very used to dealing with revolutions in information technology. In the English context, which was complicated by the politics of the Reformation, the primary motivation for the introduction of the system of printing privileges was censorship. Was a state-based system of censorship. Given the enormous social changes that were introduced by printing technology, the Tudor monarchs, having differing positions on the Reformation, were particularly concerned to control the distribution of seditious material. The subsequent development of the English copyright system, while moving away from a state-controlled system of censorship, remains focused on distribution rights, whatever the rhetoric might otherwise suggest. So what is evident in this story is that the notion of protecting innovation and creativity, actually it was absent from the origins of copyright law. What copyright law was concerned about was controlling the social and political effects of innovation. It was only when it became necessary to justify the extensive power wielded by the publishers in the system of printing privileges that the idea emerged that perhaps we should associate copyright with innovation and creativity, perhaps copyright should serve other social goals, and perhaps it should have more than an adverse relation to innovation. So the famous Statute of Anne of 1709, England's first copyright statute, was subtitled An Act for the Encouragement of Learning. It recognised authors' rights, but only as a form of residual right. It was focused on the rights of distributors, that is, the rights of publishers. So the theoretical discourse that has accompanied the development of copyright law ever since this time continues to focus on creativity, innovation, cultural production, but in its practice, in its actuality, the law focuses on primarily restrictions on distribution, use, and reuse of copyright law, which it justifies by reference to concepts of innovation and creativity. The law continues, therefore, to reflect the historical concern with the position of those who invest in the distribution of copyright works. And this is arguably, and I've made this argument many times in other places, at the expense of innovators, authors, and creators who produce the works in the first place. So copyright law, we might say, encourages distribution of creative works, and indirectly, of course, this supports production of creative works in the sense that if you produce a creative work, you're usually keen on having it distributed. But there are circumstances in which the rights given to these investors or commodifiers of copyright are so strong that they may constitute a restriction on creativity. And it is essential here to remember, and I hope no one's ever in danger of forgetting this, that all creativity draws on what went before, not what went before 100 years ago, but what went before yesterday or 2 hours ago. So distribution rights, which unnecessarily restrict access and use and reuse, result in a restriction on creativity. Okay, so now I want to move on a little bit, and I'm actually going to move to my first of my two slides in a moment. The effect of the tensions in the relationship that copyright law has created between those who invest in distribution of copyright works and those who create and innovate is no place more evident than in the information technology sector. In this sector, the information technology sector generally, copyright often looks like and is often accused of being an anti-innovation right. This is an accusation which, in some sense, returns it to its roots. The extent to which it's true to say that copyright is an anti-innovation right depends upon a sophisticated understanding, and I emphasise sophisticated, of the different interests at play and the way they relate to copyright law. In this context, and for the purpose of this presentation, there are three interest groups to which I want to draw attention. The first are those who have invested in the distribution of copyright works, publishers, producers, broadcasters, the group that has been best served by copyright protection. Secondly, we have authors and creators of copyright works whose interests have arguably been less well protected than those of distributors. And thirdly, we have a whole undifferentiated class of information technology innovators who often innovate outside the scope of copyright law. And in fact, one thing that we know about innovation as a result of this class, this third class of information technology innovators, is in fact that you don't need intellectual property protection in order to encourage innovation, as if we actually needed to be reminded of that, bearing in mind it's a relatively recent development in the history of world creativity. Okay, this third group is a very diverse group. Some parts of it are concerned with content-carrying technology. Other parts produce content, computer games, all the sorts of stuff that we carry around in our notebooks, computers, smartphones, smartwatches, smart glasses, and all the rest. But the greatest indicator of the diversity of this third group is the differing relationships that it has with copyright. Some parts of this third group have seized upon the protection offered by copyright. A good example is Microsoft, that seized upon the protection offered by copyright by this copyright trick, which says that computer programs are to be treated as literary works, in order to build a business empire based on copyright. Then there are other groups of programmers, particularly those associated with the open source movement, that rejected the copyright model as being inappropriate and operating in a way that runs counter to the process of innovation. And then there are other groups that have developed software that operates as a means of undermining the control of the distribution monopoly. In other words, my first group, my first interest group. There are lots of examples of this last group, and many have been referred to today. There's been a lot of litigation. There continues to be a lot of controversy over these types of online platforms for the supply of music, films, and so forth. I want to focus very briefly, because I know Paolo is getting agitated about the time, on this third group, because I want to think about the relationship it has to the other two groups and what we might learn about the copyright model from analysing that relationship. Because this third group has produced a an anti-copyright discourse, which it describes as a pro-innovation discourse. And this discourse depends upon a number of dichotomies that are drawn between the copyright model and this pro-innovation anti-copyright model. And I want to refer just to six of these dichotomies briefly. Okay. The first one is this dichotomy between closure and openness. Okay. Openness here, as promoted by the pro-innovation discourse, means freedom to innovate, freedom to create, freedom to produce and reuse and distribute knowledge. Closure, on the other hand, is restriction, and in this anti-copyright discourse, this means restriction on use, restriction on derivative use, restriction on distribution, all of which are possible consequences of copyright enforcement. I think the dichotomy does a disservice to copyright, because copyright, in fact, was once a much more flexible model than it is now. Theoretically, it had a number of devices that were designed to encourage circulation of information, to encourage innovation, to encourage reuse of copyright works, such as the idea-expression dichotomy, restrictions on duration, the fair use exceptions, and a host of other exceptions. The problem is, all these things have shrunk in recent times. All of those devices for making copyright flexible and open have tended to shrink. Secondly, there is this dichotomy between authorship and collaboration. Copyright has at its heart the idea of the single creative author or genius. And even though this idea is substantially corrupted in copyright law, it still is reflected in the paradigm of the law. The pro-innovation model rejects the concept of the single author or creator in favour of a concept of community creation. Not only is the community the creator, but the community is also the outcome of the creative process. The problem copyright has here is that it is very poor at recognising creative communities. It has no good discourse of the commons that might allow a type of closed or open creative community, such as that represented by the Roman law concept of res universitatis. So the idea of a community bounded by rights on the outside, but free and open on the inside for collaboration and exchange. The political implications of this idea of the creative community are interesting. We can all be part of the creative cultural economy. We're all part of the market. We're all being exploited equally. Oops. The third dichotomy is this between product and process. Copyright depends on a single finished product. It then restricts amendments to that product without the permission of the copyright owner. So for copyright, production and consumption are distinct moments. Things such as open source software, on the other hand, are dependent on a continuous process of innovation and renewal. So production and consumption are not differentiated. While some see this type of open source pro-innovation approach as recognizing the reality of the creative process, others regard it as undervaluing cognitive labor. Because if everyone's a creator, maybe then creativity is no big use. The fourth dichotomy between author and user. Copyright is based on the idea that some people are authors and some are users. And in recent times, this dichotomy has been polarized more and more as lots of high-value copyright interests are concentrated into the hands of the corporate owners who have copyright as a result of their financial investment in distribution. In other words, my first group. The fourth dichotomy is between labor and capital. Copyright is said to be based on a fundamental link between labor and property. In common law systems, it is clearly a property right and perhaps one of the freest property rights that we have. The rejection of the idea of the author by the pro-innovation discourse disrupts this idea of the link between labor and property and divorces labor and capital. Now, one consequence of this has been the proliferation in the software industry of unpaid labor, which is an interesting consequence. Final dichotomy is between license and right. And in this dichotomy, actually the line between the pro-copyright and anti-copyright pro-innovation discourse starts to get a bit vague. As we all know, copyright can always be waived or restricted through licensing devices. This is exactly how the Creative Commons works, through an extensive system of licensing. But it's also true that much of the anti-copyright pro-innovation sector relies on licenses in order to maintain its so-called openness. And some of you may be aware of this so-called viral aspect of the open source license, which depends on a copyright license. Okay, so viewed from this perspective, I think it's probably correct to say that there are some aspects of current copyright law that are anti-innovation, especially in the context of rapidly developing industries like the information technology sector. But I'm not sure that the fact that some parts are anti-innovation is a good reason for getting rid of the copyright model. Okay, to come to such a conclusion would be to advance the argument that innovation is an absolute value to which all other values should defer. Let me just give one example of what I'm trying to say here. In fact, innovation in the information technology sector is capable of being destructive of creativity. In other words, creativity and innovation are not the same thing. If musicians, writers, filmmakers are unable to get financial rewards from their creativity because we have a pro-innovation model which allows the supply of their work without them being able to enforce their economic rights, then in fact this pro-innovation discourse undercuts the creativity of other people. So, as we've already heard, what we need is a system of balances here. Because the clash between the copyright model and the pro-innovation model is really no more than a reaction against the excessively strong rights that distributors, those in my first class, that distributors have in the current copyright model. The progressive reduction of many of the exceptions and defences to this powerful right the distributors have has caused a type of overreaction against the copyright model. What we need to find in the copyright model actually is a way of supporting the second class, which represents the interests of creativity and the interests of authors. We need to rebalance copyright by focusing on this class. I think this is the way to achieve a proper balance between the type of closure that can possibly be reflected by excessive corporate control over content. And at the same time, it puts innovation in its proper place as being a part of creativity, but not overwhelming or overbalancing other forms of creativity. I think we have to be very careful about this pro-innovation, anti-copyright model. It carries with it significant social risks. Do we really want a world without authors, without finished intellectual products? Do we really want a world where creative labour can be appropriated without payment? I think the idea that lies behind the pro-innovation, anti-copyright discourse is in fact an unsophisticated overreaction to the power of the distributors, and it's there that in fact I think we need to concentrate our efforts. Thank you very much.